Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have three cases being submitted today, one of which we will hear oral argument concerning. On my right is Justice Meyer. On my left is Justice Gabriel. And we will be your panel today. So let's call the first case.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, and good afternoon. I'm here today on a case arising out of an incident that occurred at Cowboys Concert Hall on or about April 5th, 2008, in which Mr. Jones sustained some personal injuries. The primary issue I'm going to address initially is the issue of gross negligence. After a jury trial, this case was tried to a jury, and the jury found that Cowboys was grossly negligent on the finding and an answer to a jury question as to whether a gentleman by the name of Randy Anderson had committed gross negligence. In this situation, the plaintiffs chose to focus on the actions primarily of two individuals. One was a gentleman by the name of Chris Duncan, and the other man was a man by the name of Randy Anderson. They were floormen at Cowboys on the incident in question. The jury found that the gentleman named Mr. Chris Duncan had committed assault and false imprisonment. In answer to jury questions number 7 and 11, which were questions submitted to about Mr. Anderson's conduct, the jury declined to find that Mr. Anderson had either committed assault or false imprisonment. Then what's interesting is the jury, in response to the gross negligence submission, found that Mr. Duncan had not committed gross negligence, specifically rejecting that findings, but then found that Randy Anderson had committed gross negligence, although they had found earlier that Mr. Anderson had neither committed an assault nor false imprisonment. And we'll get to possible reasons why the jury would have possibly elected to go towards Mr. Anderson, but we believe that's totally circumspect and the result of improper argument at the end of the day. But there is no evidence in the record cited by either side of Mr. Anderson's conduct that comes even remotely close to clear and convincing evidence that his actions, both under the two-pronged standards of objective and subjective as required to find gross negligence, that the harm of Mr. Jones resulted from any willful or grossful neglect. Under the objective standard, there must be some deviation from the standard of care to such an extent that it creates an extreme risk of harm to others. Likewise, subjectively, there has to be some evidence that Mr. Anderson subjectively knew what he was about to do with a conscious disregard, knowing that in his own subjective mind, and nevertheless engaged in the actions that would cause harm. Now, the record undisputed before this court, cited by both sides, is that Mr. Anderson was not even involved at all with Mr. Jones. He was in a different part of the group. The groups were set up in two different parts. Mr. Anderson was with a different part. The only allegations that happened was that Mr. Duncan was involved in what they call the fall down. And Mr. Duncan, the record, both sides agree on this. It's undisputed in the record that everything was, although Mr. Jones, who was injured, was twice the legal limit of alcohol, had engaged in some conduct, as well as the son. They were asked to leave, and everybody agreed. They were polite. Cowboys was polite all up until the son turned. Cowboys contended he struck Mr. Duncan. Jones says He was just merely going back for his credit card when he made that abrupt turn. In any event, at that point, there was a fall down or a takedown. But once again, both sides have agreed, and the appellees, Mr. Jones, has embraced on appeal that Mr. Jones was not injured in the takedown. And for gross negligence, it's really irrelevant because that involved Mr. Duncan and Mr. Jones. It's undisputed that Randy Anderson was completely uninvolved.
When you say it's undisputed, don't they argue by inference that Randy Anderson was the bouncer with the long stringy hair who was kicking Mr. Jones when he was on the ground?
But that's an interesting observation, Your Honor, because they can't decide what angle they're taking. They've argued it both ways in their briefs. In their footnote number 2, they argue that the long stringy hair person was Mr. Anderson. All right. Later on in their brief, they say the long stringy hair was Mr. Duncan to support the jury's finding that Mr. Duncan committed the assault. So they can't have it both ways. But let's even examine that record. There is no evidence at all in the record that a person, quote, long stringy hair, is Mr. Anderson. And don't forget, Your Honor, Justice Gabriel, the jury specifically rejected the finding that Mr. Anderson committed the assault. The undisputed record is nobody.
Mr. Michelle, did Mr. Anderson testify at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he have long stringy hair?
I don't know that the record states.
Record doesn't say that.
And I wasn't there.
No, I'm arguing about people with hair and long hair, and we don't take pictures if we don't have them in the record.
Correct. Correct. Also, there is no link. That all that the testimony showed that was maybe somebody with long stringy hair was kicking. There was no testimony that person with long stringy hair, who was just seen kicking, actually kicked Mr. Jones. There's no evidence in the record. All if you want to look at it, the most favorable, there's somebody with long stringy hair who did some kicking. Now, even the jury didn't buy that. But I can postulate an opinion why they hop-skipped over Mr. Duncan and went to Mr. Anderson, Justice Gabriel, if you think that's really where we're getting to, is you can see it by review of their closing argument and how improper we believe it is. Because Mr. Jones's counsel repeatedly asked the question, well, you know he's a felon who just got out of jail for robbery. And the people would say no. So there's no evidence that Mr. Anderson had a criminal record, that it was a violent, that it was a criminal, and yet they repeatedly hammered that during the case, just asking these improper questions with no evidence to support that question. In bad faith. Just look at the closing argument. They hit it repeatedly. You just can't hire felons off the street and let them be bouncers in your club. Nothing could be more telling in their brief, in the appellee's brief, on the direct issue of gross negligence. They sidestep it entirely. They don't cite this court any evidence to support the finding of gross negligence. To meet the higher burden, the highest burden we have virtually in civil law, of clear and convincing that he had the both conscious, the objective and subjective elements. They sidestep it and say that Cowboys is directly negligent for negligent hiring.
Did they even plead negligent hiring?
I don't know that they was in there, Your Honor. It certainly wasn't part of the jury charge.
They didn't obtain a question on it, so
that is correct.
I need to go back and look at the record to see if it was pled, but I'm trying to figure out what the act of Randy Anderson is that supports gross negligence as it's defined and was submitted to the jury in the charge.
We're on the exact same page, Your Honor. We're at a loss. It's even hard to respond sometimes to a brief where you can't find what the allegation is. And we've got the benefit. It's kind of a belt and suspenders argument. Is not only can we not find any evidence in the record at all that Randy Anderson did anything wrong in that situation, but the jury affirmatively said no to the two questions specifically propounded on him. I think they recognized that, Justice Gabriel, when they sidestepped it in their appellee's brief and just didn't respond to the gross negligence argument and said, oh, well, we've got this direct negligence hiring. Even if we assume there was, it was pled and they had somehow obtained a jury argument, that would at most give grounds to a negligence finding. Because the only gross finding, they got one gross negligence finding, and that was only on the actions of Randy Anderson. And that's how you have to get gross negligence, is by the individual acts, because corporations only act through individuals, so they submitted Randy Anderson. aside from, we don't believe there's any evidence to support at all any finding on that, they would have to go to a second hurdle, as we well know in the case law, and also as well as in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, that they have got to find some way to impute Randy Anderson's actions onto the corporation by meeting one of the four required elements. They try to get there. Certainly there's no evidence at all that Cowboys authorized or ratified this type of action. I think the evidence is undisputed that everything they promoted was don't touch the customers. And certainly there's nothing after the fact that says, oh yeah, go ahead and, you know, take this guy out and punch him and beat him up. Secondly, the closest thing I think they can get to is if a acting, not the full-time, but the acting head floorman somehow meets the managerial requirement. And as the Texas Supreme Court stated in Quest, management doesn't mean some type of just managerial role. It typically means a higher, upper management role, some ability to hire and fire or control a division. And there's no evidence that he could hire or fire or had any division or corporate. He wasn't an officer of the company. He wasn't a vice principal of the company. So for those two independent grounds, we believe the gross negligence finding should be reversed and rendered against the plaintiffs.
Mr. Michelle.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm still interested in some of the factual allegations because
yes, Your Honor.
We've got the attacks dealing with sufficiency of the evidence. And in your brief on page 11, you say that it was acknowledged by Brenda Long that bystanders had become involved in the fracas. And it's also said on page 12 that Darren Long conceded that not all the persons in his group involved in the incident were floormen.
Correct.
And then you say on page 11, we're talking about Jeremy Jones turning to get his credit card, but the statement is made that, however, Jeremy admitted in his testimony that he had his credit card the whole time.
Yes, sir.
I didn't see that those facts and those factual allegations were contested in the appellee's brief, so I'm wondering if the evidence is conflicted and contested anywhere about those things.
I don't believe those allegations are, Your Honor. I think those are a matter of established fact. They can't point to any individual at Cowboys who struck a blow. They admitted in their brief that he was not injured in the fall down.
Mr. Jones
admitted in his appellee's brief that he was not injured during the fall down. We have attacked the sufficiency evidence on those grounds, Your Honor, because
I'm talking about Mr. Jones, the father, now. Talking about Jeremy Jones.
Yes, Mr. Jones, the appellee.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. You have it correct, Your Honor. They can't point to any evidence of any actions of any employee of Cowboys inflicting the blow. That would go further to our allegations of lack of evidence on the assault, the false imprisonment. The false imprisonment, he was handcuffed by off-duty police officers. So he was released into the custody of the police department after the incident arose. The injury in that respect, it's somewhat difficult to argue since we contend there's no evidence to support that we conducted any of the activity to then also say, well, if they did do it, hypothetically, assaulting somebody is outside the course and scope of employment. There is a presumption against an intentional tort. I know I'm almost out of time. One thing is we've cited the Texas Supreme Court case in Reliance Steel. I'm changing topics, but it does go to the end of the case about this improper argument, simply trying to inflame the jury. The Texas Supreme Court stated in Reliance Steel at 267 Southwest 3rd, 867, on page 876, I'm sorry, 874 and 875, that leading the trial court into error does not always make the error harmful, but when issues like race, religion, gender, and wealth are injected into a case unnecessarily, there's the potential for a damage not just to a litigant, but to the civil justice system. Courts must provide equal justice to all, regardless of their circumstances, and efforts suggest that jurors should not do otherwise cannot be lightly disregarded. That dovetails, Justice Gabriel, into our argument of why did they hop skip over to Randy Anderson, but it was because this repeated inflammatory arguments of Mr. Anderson being a convicted felon straight out of the pen into Cowboys when there was no evidence before the court. Thank you.
Let's give Appley an extra minute.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Let me, and I do apologize, I'm going to skip around just a little bit based upon the what at least the court and counsel seem to concentrate on. There wasn't a hop skipping around. The testimony at trial, as well as what's reflected in the record, was that there were three bouncers involved in this, a Mr. Duncan, a Mr. Mack, and a Mr. Anderson. Mr. Mack and Mr. Duncan both testified that they were the only three involved. The long stringy hair, which is Mr. Anderson, is a person who was identified as doing the kicking, which was positively identified at the trial as not being Mr. Duncan and Mr. Mack. As the court pointed out, when the people sat on the jury stand, the jurors had the ability to examine the witnesses and see what they look like and believe or disbelieve what the testimony is.
Someone actually testified that the man with the long stringy hair doing the kicking was Mr. Anderson. Somebody actually said those words.
No. What the jury did see was the jury saw the pictures which were at the time of the incident. This is what Mr. Jones looked like when he was escorted from the club. What the jury chose not to believe is that when Mr. Duncan, quote unquote, took down and held Mr. Jones on the floor with his hands behind his back, that he did not see any of the actions which created these type of damages. And you have to understand, there's three staples in the back of his head. He had a broken occipital lobe. He had a broken nose. He had damages to the knee. And yet the bouncers who held him down and escorted him out testified, we didn't see anything happen and we don't know what happened. There was no question in regard to Mr. Duncan's own testimony that he quote unquote took him down and held him down and escorted him out, and yet he testified, I didn't see anything happen, or I didn't even notice him bleeding until I picked him up off of the floor and started helping him out the door. The jury, with the direct evidence, chose to interpret that how they chose to interpret it. The three bouncers that were involved, Mr. Mack was positively identified as having been working with Jeremy. Mr. Anderson, the testimony by Mr. Duncan was two things. One is that Mr. Anderson did come over to where Mr. Jones was on the floor. There was direct testimony of that. And there was also direct testimony that Mr. Anderson previously had been reprimanded at least twice in regard to touching or getting rough with the clientele. The only two people that were positively identified as having gone to Mr. Jones, who was on the floor, was Mr. Duncan, who was holding him down, and Mr. Anderson, who walked over to where Mr. Jones was lying on the floor on his stomach with his hands behind him. Mr. Anderson was positively in the testimony in the record put at Mr. Jones's location. And please understand, the essential defense in this case was that Mr. Jones' son had started an incident. But that incident was 10 to 30 feet away from Mr. Jones. There was no reason for Mr. Jones to have been taken down. That was one of the other elements that came out, is Mr. Jones didn't do anything which was causation or an exacerbating situation which would create an issue of imminent harm. But he was taken down. The jury chose, based upon the testimony, to find that, in fact, Mr. Duncan, in taking him down, sitting on him, holding his hands behind his back, had false imprisoned and assaulted. The jury chose, based upon the fact that the testimony was Mr. Anderson was there, Mr. Anderson did have long, stringy hair, and that at least one of the items...
Mr. Anderson had long, stringy hair?
No, that's what the jury is able to look at and interpret, Your Honor. That's the reason that the jury has...
What we have to look at is if there's evidence to support what the jury found. And my question is simply, is there anything in the record that we're going to find to support any... that Mr. Anderson had long, stringy hair?
No, but I would purport to the court that is one of the reasons that the jury is the fact finder in these situations, and that we should not attempt to supplant or remove what their personal observations and what they choose to believe and disbelieve.
Well, based on what could they choose to believe that he had long, stringy hair?
Other than his testimony and his appearance at the trial?
Okay, what testimony?
That Mr.
Had long, stringy hair?
No, that Mr. Anderson, in fact, after assisting in taking down Jeremy, did go to assist Mr. Duncan in regard to Mr. Jones.
Okay.
And so he was placed at the scene, and there was only three bouncers that were positively identified as being there, which means that we have Mr. Mack, who was at that point in time working with Mr. Jeremy. We had Mr. Duncan, who was holding Mr. Jones down, and the third one, Mr. Anderson, was the only other bouncer that was there, and he was put at the scene of where this occurred. The jury can, by those facts, make a determination that if somebody, one of the bouncers, kicked Mr. Jones, that left one probable, if not indisputable, person to have done it, which was Mr. Anderson. There was nobody else that would have been there that was
apparently the jury didn't believe that by a preponderance of the evidence, because they found that he did not assault or falsely imprison Mr. Jones.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. And again, the jury findings are based upon what the jury sits down in their recollection of what the direct testimony and the facts are. And I don't dispute that. By the same token, the jury did make a determination as to Mr. Anderson's negligence in this issue, I do believe. And I would also point out a couple of things. One is, as cited, the Duran versus Moore case is a case which is very much on point with this case. And that was a bouncer case, and that is, if your scope of duties includes physically touching, physically removing, physically handling people, and then you then go, if you will, a step beyond that, which in this case, the bouncer actually threw a glass, I believe, and hit the patron with it, that is not unforeseeable that within the scope of your duties that you would exceed them by that type of action. If you're a bouncer and your job is to essentially manhandle people, then if you manhandle people and they get injured, it is foreseeable. But what the appellants want you to do in this case is to sit in the booth of the jury who sat through 4 days of this trial and supplant what their determination of what they believed happened was. That's what they're asking you to do. And the other thing that I think should be brought to the attention is that one of the reasons, also I would bring up that in regard to closing arguments, they didn't object. in the closing arguments except one objection. And that objection was when the statement was made that no criminal background check was done. And they objected, and the court cautioned counsel to stay within the scope of the testimony and the evidence. All of their other claims in regard to improper jury evidence, they didn't make those objections at the time of trial, which was the appropriate place to have made those objections. Second thing I'd like to point out is that one of the reasons, and they went to a fairly long dialogue about the agreements in regard to the jury issues, was because the corporate representative who was under subpoena and had appeared at the first 3 days of trial on the date of her trial did not appear. And the case was continued. And the case was continued to a second day where she did not appear. And the court inquired as to her availability, and the court determined that there was not excusable reason for her not to be there, especially under subpoena. At which point, the agreements were reached on the record in regard to the jury submission issues. And that was effectively that we would not make objections in regard to the jury issues. And in fact, there were no objections in regard to the issues submitted to the jury. They now want to come back after having not made, after, even if you take out the stipulation of the parties, they failed to make those objections to the jury charge at the time the jury charge was submitted and prior to the point in which it was submitted to the jury.
I perceive they agreed not to object to the form of the jury submission as opposed to whether evidence supports a jury's answer.
I would agree with that.
You can't object ahead of time to whether evidence supports a jury's answer. You certainly can object ahead of time to the wording of the question.
And I agree with that, Your Honor, entirely. And that's what I'm saying. That's what we had agreed to. For them to now come back and say that the issues were improperly submitted on the form, they've waived those objections. The only question is there adequate evidence to support the jury's findings on those issues? And then we go to the scintilla of evidence. And that is, if you take all of the record and take a look at it, and you throw out the testimony which does not support the jury's finding, is there any evidence left in the record to support it? We believe there was. In fact, there was not one, but one JNOV and two motions for new trial in which all of those arguments were made to the trial court, who also was present for the trial. And all of those arguments were overruled by the court.
Counsel, how do you reconcile, or do you even feel it's necessary to reconcile the jury's answers in finding that Randy Anderson did not commit an assault and did not commit a false imprisonment with the answers on question number 16 as asking about clear and convincing evidence and gross negligence, and they answered no to the first two and yes to the third one, 16. Do you view that as a conflict first?
No, I don't view that as a conflict because I think in the jury's mind, the two defendants or the two corporate people did two different things. And you have to remember that there was no argument to the fact that Mr. Duncan admitted that he took down Mr. Jones, sat on his back, and held his hands behind his back. That's one set of actions. The jury then looked and said, well, he did that. They then looked to the testimony about who was the other person that was over there that would have also have committed the assault, the kicking, which I think the jury could legitimately determine was probably not Mr. Duncan based upon the fact he was sitting on Mr. Jones' back with his hands behind him. And since Mr. Anderson had moved away from Jeremy, gone back over to where Mr. Jones was, that left him as being the logical and undisputed culprit as having been the one that would have committed, if you will, the kicking. And I think they differentiated those in their mind, saying one held him down, the other beat him up, if you will.
You know, that's a whole lot of thinking of what the jury might have meant whenever what they did was answer to question number 7, did Randy Anderson commit an assault against Bruce Jones? And the answer is no. Wouldn't kicking be an assault?
I would think it would be an assault. And if I were sitting there, I would agree with you, Your Honor.
Well, my concern is when you're suggesting that we might be putting ourselves in the place of a jury and making determinations that are raised in the points on appeal, that we can read and mm-hmm. what the answers are, they are, and they appear to be in conflict to me.
Your Honor, I'm not necessarily going to disagree with the court, but I think that's what runs us.
I'm not asking you to disagree.
Give
me your viewpoint.
And I think that's one of the issues that we run into, and that is that whatever it was that the jury heard that in their minds created that situation, that's a factual issue, Your Honor, as to what they did. And I understand the court's dilemma in regard to the differentiation of the parties and probably should have been overlap. I don't disagree with that. But again, you're back to the issue of if a jury hears evidence and a jury makes a factual finding of it, is there anything in the record to support it? And my simple contention is that, yes, there was. Your Honor.
I have one more question.
Sure.
I'm confused about something. I thought Mr. Michelle said that Mr. Anderson testified at trial. In your brief on page 15, footnote 2, you say both McElroy and Duncan testified at trial while Anderson could not be found.
That is correct. My understanding, and I believe by my recollection, is that it was a videotaped deposition that was replayed.
But there was testimony from Anderson?
Your Honor, I believe there was, but I believe it was videotaped. It was not live testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
And I am subject to being wrong about that, Your Honor. I do apologize. But I remember one of the witnesses was via taped deposition, and I do believe that was which one it was. But, Your Honor, at the end of the day, I think the real problem the jury had was this. They saw what Mr. Jones looked like when he was handcuffed and brought out of that club. He had to go spend 9 hours in an emergency ward. And at the same time, you have three bouncers who concluded that, in fact, they did take him down, they did escort him out, they were in the vicinity, but none of them saw or concluded that they saw anything happen to him, and they don't know how these type of injuries occurred. And the jury doesn't have to believe that.
All right, let's give appellant an extra minute.
Justice Gabriel, I think I might have misspoke. I might have been thinking of Mr. Duncan, who testified live at the trial. Mr. McElroy was by videotape, I believe. With regard to the evidence that they point to, the appellees cite in footnote number 2 that they make a reference about long stringy hair, but then in their footnote, they have no record cite to support their statement in footnote number 2. So to answer your question, which I think has been confirmed, they didn't have any testimony regarding those factors, and I don't believe Mr. Anderson did testify at the trial. And Justice Meyer, I think you're exactly right to say an assault of kicking under this new theory, first time I've heard it, is that Duncan held him while Anderson kicked him. Certainly, I've seen no evidence of that in the record. Secondly, it's almost unimaginable if that type of testimony did come in that the jury wouldn't have found Mr. Anderson had committed an assault if they had testimony that Mr. Anderson was the one who was kicking Mr. Jones. On that basis alone, there's no evidence to support those findings. With regard to the agreement, I believe Appellee's counsel has agreed with our summation is that the agreement was we wouldn't object to the form of the question, but certainly we reiterated, I counted at least 3 or 4 times in the excerpts we cited to the court, where we were preserving our objection to say that there was no evidence to support, and I believe Appellee agrees with that position based on the way I've heard his argument. And certainly we followed what we told the trial court we were going to do, which was to make a motion for directed verdict that there's no evidence. Finally, if it was anything else other than that, it was somehow a stipulation of gross negligence, why submit the gross negligence question at all if it's a stipulation of liability? So on those grounds, we were objecting that and believe there's still no evidence to support the jury's finding with regard to gross negligence on any of those. Finally, with
regard— Let me ask you a question about what relief you're asking for. Let's just hypothetically assume for a minute that we bought both of your arguments that you made in your opening. One requires a new trial and one requires dispensing with exemplary damages.
Yes, the first request is with regard to gross negligence. We believe that is a reverse in render, would dispense with gross negligence. You're correct. Also, we have also asserted additional arguments as to the underlying tort claims, liabilities that we believe.
I understand.
I'm just asking
you on those two issues, what would be the fallout?
I'm sorry, I don't know if I understand it. The render, the gross would go away.
I understand.
I'm sorry, I may not understand
all right. The
question.
I'll sort it out.
But our second issue is, though, on the underlying, there's no evidence to support the underlying torts on Duncan as well, other on negligence, assault, or false imprisonment, or alternatively, lack of causation as to the damages, which would be a render and not a retrial. If they're insufficient on those evidence, that would be a remand for trial on the factual sufficiency of the evidence. Finally, on some of the damage individual, these are some of the smaller issues that we've highlighted at the end. For example, he testified as to gross wages of $1,000. Of course, we've cited a number of cases that you've got to have net damages. Also under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, you've got to have after-tax testimony, neither of which were met. They didn't have any testimony or affidavits to support the reasonable necessity of the medical damages, except for $2,500. So if the court does get past some of our underlying liability issues, we believe also the evidence is insufficient to meet the pain and suffering element, the medical damages, and the net profits versus the lost profits. So in short, Justice McCoy, we believe a reverse and render, take nothing judgment would be appropriate. Subject to that, a reverse and render on the gross, and if the court finds there's some sufficient evidence on the underlying tort claims, that would be a reverse and remand. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Your case is submitted. And if the clerk will adjourn, we are adjourning to consider our three cases that we have submitted today.